Are we a declining race? An Old Sailor's Verdict by Walter Hunt. It is not with any pretension to literary ability that I venture to approach this all-important question, nor even with the confidence of being able to make the subject sufficiently palatable for the general public. But having had opportunities of witnessing the effects of certain habits on the physique of peoples, both in savage life and in civilized communities, also having devoted a considerable number of years to the study of the subject, I am led to hope that what I have to say, resulting from my experience and studies, may be of some value. As far back as 20 years ago, I had arrived at the startling conclusion that there was a general physical degeneration, not only in our own country, nor even limited to civilized countries, but extended over the entire world. Such a statement, if made at that time, would have met with very few supporters. Subsequent events, however, have only more fully convinced me that I was right, both in my recognition of the fact of the general decline and in my conclusions as to the causes which, during all historical time, have been leading up to this deplorable result. My reasons for thinking as I do, and the connecting circumstances, are perhaps somewhat imperfectly stated, and if that be so, I ask the indulgence of the listener, at the same time urging the importance of the subject matter. Streatham, June the 17th, 1904. Are we a declining race? An Old Sailor's Verdict. Chapter 1. These Degenerate Days. A ponderous stone bold Hector heaved to throw, pointed above and rough and gross below. Not two strong men the enormous weight could raise, such men as live in these degenerate days. Homer. The old cry of wolf, wolf, the complaint that we are not as good as our forebears, has been echoed from one generation to another, from time immemorial, until at last the tendency is to attach but little importance to its repetition. Today, however, the question of degeneration is forcing itself more and more upon our notice, and signs are not wanting that the public mind is disturbed about it. And yet the question has been for long a source of anxiety to the student of humanity. Its solution, rendered more difficult by the unnatural social conditions of our time, is of the greatest immediate importance. More than 2,000 years ago, the poet Aristophanes said of the Athenians, "In the good old times, our youths breasted the snow without a mantle. Their music was masculine and martial, their gymnastic exercises decorous and chaste. Thus were trained the heroes of Marathon." Isocrates, a great orator of the same period, said, quote, "Thus our young men did not waste their days in the gaming houses, nor with music girls, nor in the assemblies, in which whole days are now consumed." Close quote. The Greeks learned afterwards that the reproach was only too well founded. So it has been with Rome, with every other great nation, and so it is with us. To every successive generation, similar warnings are addressed. The idea, in all classes of society, has frequently been made the subject of song, and in our naval service the contrast between old navy and young navy was a constant incitement to repartee. When, at the close of the Crimean War, large numbers of men were paid off, they sang, and by all accounts with a certain amount of reason, quote, "They are paying off all our seamen bold, thinking them they'll want no more, but the navy never will be manned as it was in 54." Close quote. 20 years later, there was another clearance of a certain class of men, reckoned undesirables. About that time, 1874 or 1875, several alterations were effected in the navy, including a different scale of punishments, and many seamen whose characters were classed as indifferent were not available for promotion and were not allowed to re-engage. Not that there was any real vice in them, but merely because they did not come aboard directly when their leave expired, or because they sometimes managed to get an extra tot of grog. Also, about that time, several ships were lost with all hands. HMS Captain, in 1871, went down with about 600 men in the Bay of Biscay. HMS Eurydice capsized in a snowstorm, losing all hands except three. HMS Atlanta sailed away into the North Atlantic and was never again heard of. HMS Dotterall was blown up in the Straits of Magellan. About this time, too, we saw the last of the old wooden line of battleships as seagoing vessels. This general clear-out and the invention of a new type of vessel, in which seamanship was rendered to a certain extent unnecessary, seems to have evolved a new class of men, differing in many respects from the sea dogs of Nelson's time. I do not say that they are an inferior class. Intellectually, they are no doubt superior, for many of the old school were illiterate, which would be impossible in the navy at the present day, as the complexity of the sailor's duties now necessitate a great deal of study. Physically, there is no gainsaying the fact that the men, both in the army and the navy, have undergone a great change. Anyone who remembers Portsmouth some 30 years ago, when the 42nd Black Watch was stationed there, will readily acknowledge that it would be hard to find now such types of manhood as were then seen in the 42nd, in the Blue Marines at Eastney, and among the seamen gunners of the Excellent. Many of the latter volunteered for the Arctic expedition that fitted out at Portsmouth in 1874, in Her Majesty's ships Alert and Discovery. The rollicking, happy-go-lucky, broad-shouldered, hairy-chested Jack Tar seems as a type to have disappeared, and we now have a more sedate and, according to public opinion, more respectable class of men to man our iron walls. Yet it must be borne in mind that mere respectability, rightly or wrongly termed such, cannot successfully replace hardihood in such a rough and ready life as that of a seaman. Only a few months ago, I read, in Truth, that the trial trip of one of Her Majesty's ships had to be abandoned because the greater part of the men were incapacitated through seasickness. Shade of Nelson. This is a most alarming state of affairs if the vessel was manned by bluejackets, as seems to have been the case. For the editor of The Truth, commenting on the condition of the men, hints at improper feeding as a cause. As a matter of fact, the men are fed very much better now than they were 30 years ago. In the first place, owing to greater facilities of transport, provisions may be carried to foreign stations in better condition than formerly, and the food is not allowed to lie for years at foreign depots before being used. Then there is the improved system of preserving meats, canning, etc., and the condensing of water. Not only this, but every ship seems to be supplied with a canteen, where all kinds of preserves may be purchased, a thing scarcely known in a seagoing ship in my time. We sometimes had to exist on food that would not be considered fit to offer for sale in this country. I remember on one occasion that the salt pork was so exceptionally bad that we took it on the quarterdeck to protest against having to eat it. We were in the southwestern Pacific, among the Cannibal Islands at the time, and had been living on salt provisions for about 8 months. The captain looked at the meat and very logically remarked, "It certainly is very rich, but what are we to do? There is no other in the ship, so that if we pitch it overboard, we shall have to starve." So we had to exist for another 2 months on this rich diet, with no change but an occasional coconut or a banana when we could get them. Here is a description of our provender. The biscuit was so far gone with the weevil and maggot that there was scarcely a piece to be found, the size of a half crown, that was not perforated with these vermin, the greater part of it being reduced to dust. This, with a pint of cocoa, which was very ancient and had a decidedly mouldy flavour, served without milk, formed our breakfast. For dinner, there was a little variation. Every alternate day, we had the salt pork already referred to, with some split peas added to the water, in which it was boiled, making a very savoury pea soup. Once in 4 days, we had what was supposed to be salt beef, and plum pudding, quite a luxurious sounding title, but one would scarcely have recognised the article under that name. The flour was often animated by the same kind of life which affected the biscuit, and the plums were few and far between. The beef was always a doubtful substance. Some called it rhinoceros, but it generally went by the name of salt horse. Once in 4 days, also, we had what was then a new experiment, Australian tinned meat, with a mysterious substance called preserved potatoes, which few could eat without afterwards suffering from heartburn. The midday meal was washed down by a half gill of rum. For supper, 4:30 p.m, we had tea, boiled in the same coppers in which the pea soup had just previously been cooked, no milk, and another half pound of biscuit, after which we fasted 14 hours to allow it to digest. This was the ordinary sea-going fare of 30 years ago. Therefore, if the men have had the advantage of augmenting their diet from the canteen, and the spread of civilization with its greater facilities of transit enables them to obtain fresh provisions oftener, it is evident that the decline of physique cannot be due to the feeding. Far from objecting to an improved scale of diet, I am very glad that this is now being seen to, and that our sailors are to have better food and more meals. The decline is apparent in still greater degree in the army. The terrible amount of sickness and disease during the war in South Africa, from exposure in what might be termed a moderate climate, shows the stamina of our soldiers to be very inferior. There was a startling revelation made by Major General Sir Frederick Morris, KCB, in an article published in the Contemporary Review for January 1903, dealing with national health. He wrote, quote, "During the last 7 years, it has been one of my duties to visit the Herbert Hospital for the purpose of sanctioning the discharge of men who had been brought forward by a medical board as no longer fit for Her Majesty's service. I very soon found that an alarming proportion of these men had involved the state in considerable expense, but had given no return. As soon as they were put to an average amount of work, they broke down in health, had to be sent to hospital, and if, after being patched up, they were sent back to duty, they broke down again, and on the whole, their record showed that they never had at any time become efficient soldiers. According to the best estimate I have been able to arrive at, it has been for many years true that out of every 5 men who wish to enlist, and primarily offer themselves for enlistment, you will find that by the end of 2 years' service, there are only 2 remaining in the army as efficient soldiers. To me, it seems a vital matter for us to inquire, what is the meaning of that disastrous proportion between the five and the two? Does it mean that the class which necessarily supplies the bulk of the ranks of our army consists of this large proportion of men physically unfit? If so, what are the causes of this fatal condition of things, and are they remediable? It will be convenient first to record the immediate causes which seem to produce the greater number of cases of physical breakdown. Unquestionably, heart weaknesses, pneumonia troubles, and rheumatism, with its sequelae, supply a large number. Numbers of them have been unable to digest their food on account of bad teeth. Bad teeth are also a frequent cause of rejection. We have to remember that the young man of 16 to 18 is what he is because of the training through which he has passed during his infancy. Therefore, it is to the condition of the women and children that we must look if we have regard to the future of our land. The question with which I am dealing here is one about which it is vital for us to know the truth. We cannot get at it without searching investigation. And from whom are we to get it? Is it or is it not true that the whole labouring population of the land are at present living under conditions which make it impossible that they should rear the next generation to be sufficiently virile to supply more than 2 out of 5 men effective for the purposes of either peace or war? We want the truth. If by any investigation we could ascertain the true meaning of those figures, the 5 and the 2, which I have given, it may be that we should be able to achieve a real step towards the securing of national health, and thereby to the maintaining of a virile race, able to hold for us, and to hand down to our children's children, the precious heirloom which has been handed down to us by virile forefathers. Close quote. I have quoted largely from this article because I think it is all of great importance. It reveals a state of affairs which is still quite unsuspected by many. Coming from such an authority, it carries all the more weight, as it is obvious that it would not be to the writer's interest or advantage to disparage the condition of the men who go to swell the ranks of the army. We want the truth. The trouble is that people are not always ready to acknowledge the truth when it is given to them. The truth is easy to get in most cases, and this is as simple as most. Since the publication of Sir Frederick Morris's article, I have heard it stated from a public platform by a man of some authority that out of 10,000 youths who presented themselves for enlistment in Manchester, only 3,000 were accepted. And of the 3,000 accepted, 2,000 were weeded out as being medically unfit. This shows us that only 1 in 10 of those likely to volunteer for service in the army are physically fit to endure the hardships connected with a military life. Suppose, for the sake of fairness, we take the more moderate and perhaps more reliable statement as to the 5 and the 2, and then refer back some 2 or 3 thousand years and make a comparison between the soldier of today and the soldier of that period. Referring to the article on Sparta in the London Encyclopedia, we read, quote, "Till a man was 30 years old, he was not capable of serving in the army, as the best authors agree. After 40 years' service, a man was, by law, no longer required to go into the field, and consequently, if the military age was 30, the Spartans were not held to be invalids till they were 70. Close quote. What an eye-opener this is to us, who should have profited by the experience of the centuries which have elapsed since the age of Spartan supremacy. Many men of our time have seen the best of their lives at the age of 30, and most men are decrepit before they reach 70. For the quality of the Spartan soldier, one has only to refer to the Battle of Thermopylae, and for their marching abilities to the Battle of Marathon. They arrived the day after the battle, having covered a distance of 150 miles in 3 days. As the Spartans only employed heavy armed infantry, this was a great achievement. Their arms consisted of sword, shield, and heavy spear. As we do not read of any baggage trains accompanying these expeditions, we may conclude that they carried their provisions with them, or that they had to forage for them on the way. It is not likely that the commissariat was a very extensive department with the Spartans at any time, for they were very frugal. Quote, "The youths only were allowed to eat flesh. Older men ate black broth and pulse." Close quote. This does not sound very inviting. We are told that black broth was made of salt, vinegar and blood, etc., whatever the etc. might be. Quote, "If they were moderate in their eating, they were in their drinking also. Thirst was the sole measure thereof, and no Lacedaemonian ever thought of drinking for pleasure." Close quote. What a contrast to our 20th century customs. It is hardly too much to say that we do nothing except for pleasure, and moderation is a virtue seldom taught. Quote, "It was the care of Lycurgus that from their very birth the Lacedaemonians should be inured to conquer their appetites." Close quote. Surely we shall have to learn from the ancients how to solve our problem. Moderation seems to have been the text of the wisest of their philosophers. Socrates taught that the victory over human habits and passion, which shall bring them into such subjection as to be subservient to the real advantage of the possessor, is that necessary virtue which philosophers denominate temperance. And thus Democritus, quote, "To conquer oneself is the noblest victory. He is the valiant man who conquers not enemies merely, but desire." Close quote. And thus Antisthenes, quote, "The end of philosophy is to subdue the passions and prepare for every condition of life." Close quote. The demoralization of that noble race had already commenced when these maxims were recorded. Luxury and indulgence were already beginning to undermine the phenomenal grandeur to which the Greeks had attained. The intellect of the Athenian and the physique of the Spartan were rapidly becoming absorbed by dissipations which had been detrimental to the race in all ages. End of chapter 1. Chapter 2. Insanity and Alcoholism. The case is hard where a good citizen is doomed to pay the lamentable score of guilt accumulated long before, quite undeservedly doomed to atone in other times for actions not his own. Theognis. The question of deterioration does not apply only to the army and the navy. The fact is just as evident in civil life as it is on the lower deck or in the barrack room. Indeed, it is noticeable in all classes of the community. From the statesman to the chimney sweep, there seems to be the same lack of physical and mental fitness. Critics seem to have directed the greater part of their attention to the labouring class, and yet, although it may be true that incapacity is rendered more conspicuous in those who have to depend upon physical labour for a livelihood, the percentage of physically unfit is not found to be greater in that class than in any other. The ranks of pauperism are not necessarily recruited from the working classes alone. There are very many paupers who have never been bona fide workers in any grade of society, but have drifted from all classes. They are the old man of the sea to the workers, but they no more belong to them than they do to the aristocracy or to the professional world. If it were possible to trace the pedigrees of these unfortunate individuals, it would be a great surprise to many who wish to wash their hands of their responsibility for them. It would be found that no professions or classes were unrepresented among them, and it is a disgrace to the country that the poor should have to bear the burdens of the very poor, or that the unemployed should be saddled with the unemployable. By unemployable, I mean not the incorrigibly lazy, but people who are really incapable, who at the second or third day's work would break down, who go to crowd the casual wards of our workhouses and fill our hospitals and lunatic asylums. Their numbers are steadily, one might say almost rapidly, increasing. One of the most alarming features of this problem is the marvellous increase in lunacy. Statistics issued by the London County Council for the 10 years ending March the 31st, 1901, show an increase of nearly 50%. With regard to lunacy, the number of lunatics for which the County Council is required to find accommodation has increased from 10,326 in 1891 to 15,511 in 1901, or about 50% in 10 years. The total number of lunatics belonging to the County of London, including imbeciles, in the workhouses on January the 1st, 1901, was 21,369. The census for the same period showed an increase of population of about 7.5%, so that the spread of insanity is out of all proportion to the growth of the population. Hereditary influences and old age are reported to be by far the most prevalent predisposing causes, while drink and domestic and business troubles are the most common exciting causes. Later statistics show that the case is getting worse. Lunacy continues to be on the increase in England and Wales. On January the 1st, 1903, there were 113,964 notified lunatics, being an increase of 3,251 on last year's number. The ratio of insane to population is a little more than 34 to 10,000. That is to say, one in every 293 persons is insane. This ratio has steadily increased from the year 1859, when the proportion was 18.67 per 10,000, or 1 in 536. What do these figures mean? Almost a whole percent increase in lunacy during a little over 40 years, and the worst feature in the case is that the greater increase has taken place within the last 12 years. Does this not mean decline? Who can view with indifference these indications of deterioration? Yet very little is done to check the evil. We build asylums, and they are filled almost as soon as they are complete. We appoint proper attendants and provide the patients with every nourishment. At the same time, the real cause of the calamity is allowed to remain unchallenged. There are few that dare do more than hint at what might really be the cause. More than 60 years ago, Sir W.C. Ellis, then resident physician at Hanwell Asylum, cautioned the medical profession that a certain vice was a fertile source of insanity. He said, quote, "I have no hesitation in saying that in a very large number of cases in all public asylums, the disease may be attributed to that cause." Close quote. The vice alluded to has been recognised by the profession as a cause of insanity, and when cases are brought under its notice, medical men do all in their power to restrain the victims. But such treatment is like locking the stable door once the steed has been stolen. Knowledge on a matter of such vital importance should not remain with medical men alone, It should be public property. All parents should be able to instruct their children on such subjects, so that they may not rush blindly into the terrible pitfalls awaiting them on every hand. Dr. R. P. Ritchie, resident surgeon at Bethnal House Asylum, published in 1861 a very instructive work on frequent causes of insanity among young men. Dr. Copland and several others have written on the subject, but these works have been written for medical reference chiefly, so that the general public has not profited much by them. This is, perhaps, where medical men are mostly to blame. They do not give us the straight tip on these questions. Hereditary influences and old age are given us as being by far the most prevalent predisposing causes. It seems strange that either of these causes should be given as very prevalent. Take old age, for instance. The very fact of the average of life being lowered to about 34 years indicates that we do not live to a great age. This in itself is evidence of decline in the race. If any reliance is to be placed on statistics, we find that during the 17th and 18th centuries, people were credited with living to a much greater age than they do at present. We are bound to place a certain amount of confidence in the statements of such men as Sir John Sinclair, Dr. Fothergill, Mr. Whitehurst, etc. Sir John Sinclair recorded a very good example of sturdy old age among the Greenwich pensioners who were living in 1802. 95 of them were over 80 years of age. Their habits would scarcely be considered as conducive to old age. 42 of the 95 were moderate drinkers. The remainder were in the habit of drinking freely, some of them very freely. 59 were in the habit of chewing tobacco, while most of the others took snuff. These men were each allowed 2 quarts of beer per day with their meals, so that the moderate drinkers, if they took their full rations, were in the habit of taking as much beer as today would make some people drunk. Those who drank freely, we should probably consider as regular tipplers. One of these pensioners, John Moore, was 102 years of age and had served 31 years in the Navy. According to statistics, he drank freely, chewed tobacco freely, and had 4 new teeth. Dr. Jameson, in commenting on the teeth, says that third teeth are commonly accounted a great mark of old age. The famous Countess of Desmond, who lived to the great age of 140 years, is said to have had a third set of teeth. According to Easton's On Longevity, 1799, there were records of 1,712 centenarians during the 17th and 18th centuries. Of these, no less than 277 were above 110 years and under 120 years of age. 84 of them were above 120 years. 26 over 130, 7 over 140, 3 of them were over 150 years, 2 of them over 160, and 3 of them were between the ages of 170 years and 185 years old. Dr. Fothergill and Mr. Whitehurst give the names of many of these people and the counties where they resided. To go back to an earlier date, Lord Bacon assures us, from most incontestable evidence, that in AD 76, when a general taxation was made over the Roman Empire by Vespasian, they were found living in Italy, between the Apennines and the River Po, no fewer than 124 persons aged 100 and upwards. Of these, 4 were 130, 4 were 136, and 3 were 140 years old. And, even on this island, things were very different to what they are now. Rapin, in the introduction to his History of England, says, quote, "The Britons were generally tall and well made, Their constitutions were so good that, according to Plutarch, they frequently lived 120 years. This length of days was due more to their sobriety and temperance than to the wholesomeness of the air. Close quote. It may be objected that in the absence or uncertainty of records, these figures are unreliable. Possibly this may be so in point of accuracy, still they show that these people usually lived to a very great age. It has also been noted of savage races that certain tribes, before coming much into contact with the Europeans, were of superior physique and some lived to a great age, but that unfortunately they so soon adopt our habits and vices that they deteriorate before we have an opportunity to study their characters. Old age, then, can scarcely be accepted as a most prevalent predisposing cause of insanity. Hereditary influences may bear a more serious relation to our problem, but this only indicates that something is radically wrong in our mode of life. Heredity seems to be using us very severely just now. Not only are maniacal and suicidal propensities transmitted to us, but our children are losing their teeth almost as soon as they can walk. In some cases, even their milk teeth decay before they are shed, and toothache may be counted as among their earliest remembrances. Eyesight also suffers from this cause. Eyesight is defective in the majority of our youth. It would almost seem that Mr. K. Robinson's prophecy from the 19th century, written in May 1883, that the human being of the future will be a toothless, bald, toeless creature with flaccid muscles and limbs almost incapable of locomotion. This is likely to come to pass during the present century. We shall soon arrive at that state at the rate that we are going. We may live to witness the disappearance of our teeth and hair, but the toes, of course, will take much longer to disappear through disuse. Muscular atrophy we are certainly suffering from, as witness the unemployable whose ranks are increasing so fast. And after Mr. K. Robinson's human being, what next? The sequel to that may be found in Dr. Lister's address to the Saturday Hospital Fund meeting at the Mansion House, April the 25th, 1903. Of every 1,000 babies born in London, 160 do not live to the age of 12 months. In Manchester and Liverpool, it is worse, for 200 per 1,000 never live to that age. And in Berlin, the alarming figure of 268 per 1,000 is reached. What about those who only just survive? What bright prospects for the posterity of such a noble race? Lunatic asylums and hospitals can scarcely be built fast enough. According to the annual report of the Registrar General, 21,039 infants under 1 year old died in London alone in 1900. Of these, 1,638 did not live 3 months. A great percentage of women are unable to nurse their children. One doctor states, quote, "At the hospital for sick children, 90% of the deaths from diarrhea occur in hand-fed children." Close quotes. How long is this massacre of innocents to last? It will last until we resolve to return to a mode of life in which the just dues of posterity are recognised. I have just been reading an article in the Westminster Review for September 1903 by H. Ripon Seymour on the result of the Royal Commission on Physical Training in Scotland, 1902. It shows a most deplorable condition of health among the children, mostly those attending the board schools at Edinburgh, especially those of the poorer districts. The alarming discovery was made that 700 children were suffering from unrecognised phthisis, 1,300 from unrecognised heart disease, 12,000 from ear diseases, and 15,000 from lesser ailments. About one-third of the children of Edinburgh were requiring immediate medical attendance. This condition was generally ascribed to improper feeding and want of proper physical training. I believe our children are being fed better than they were ever fed before. We must look beyond the feeding, although that must not be neglected. Give them better food, by all means, but at the same time, let them have sound physiological instruction. Let their parents also have some physiological instruction. They need it. It has been suggested that the children are overworked. Some of them are employed out of school hours and go to school exhausted and unfit for instruction. Undoubtedly, there are cases in which children have to work out of school hours for the simple reason that their parents cannot afford to feed them properly unless they do something to bring in a little money. In many cases, the restrictions imposed on parents make it very hard for them. But to return to one's sheep, as the French say, drink is generally acknowledged as a common cause of lunacy. Many people, no doubt, would describe alcoholic excess as the principal cause. While it cannot be denied that drink is a powerful factor in the production of insanity, it is not an independent cause. There is another element at work, which is the cause of most inebriates giving way to drink, and the same element is in itself a cause of insanity. Alcoholism is as much a result of demoralization as it is a cause of demoralization, and the inebriate is not a free agent, for inebriety is in itself a disease. Dr. Norman Kerr, in his work on inebriety, page 178, gives a very plausible reason, as I shall presently show, for people giving way to alcoholism. He explains how it is that many newly married people give way without being themselves able to actually understand the cause. There has always been a certain amount of mystery about the case of the young man who within a few months or a few years of marriage gradually becomes a sot. From this condition, he is almost irreclaimable, and in many cases it takes but a very little alcohol to keep him in a semi-intoxicated condition, because he is physically degraded. In such cases, we must look beyond drink for the cause. We frequently discover that it is possible for one man to take a great deal more alcohol and remain sober and free from its allurements than another, who might get drunk and remain a slave to its use. This shows that it is a physiological as well as a moral problem, and should be so considered. Thus, Socrates, having a clean soul in a clean body, could drink his boon companions under the table, and then go out himself and take the morning air. What was a blemish and a defect in them being simply an added power of enjoyment to himself. It is an unfortunate thing that what might be considered as a comparatively harmless source of pleasure should be converted into a most terrible scourge, for such is our present demoralized condition that alcohol has proved to be. If then alcohol is such a curse to civilization, why not forbid its use? If it is such a common cause of insanity, why not close the public houses and make it illegal to sell it as a beverage? Surely this would be the easiest way out of the difficulty. Or is it too great a source of revenue for our legislators to give it up yet? Or is it too profitable an investment for our speculators to forego their interest in its manufacture? I am told that there are many parsons, even, who are brewery shareholders, so that there is not much likelihood of our public houses being closed just yet. The reform must come from the people themselves. Insanity and alcoholism are the result of physical degeneration, and we must attack the cause of the degeneration before we can overcome either. Almost as if in answer to the prophecy of Mr. K. Robinson, two works have just appeared, both by medical men, one a Russian and the other a New Zealander, who deplore conditions actually existing which seem to indicate that we are fast approaching the state pictured by him. Dr. V. Verasaf assures us that, quote, our olfactory organ has become quite rudimentary. The sensibility of the cutaneous nerves to variations of temperature and their faculty of regulating the calorification of the body has become appreciably lessened. The glandular tissue of the female breast is becoming atrophied. Considerable weakness of sexual energy is noticeable. The bones are becoming smaller. The first and the floating ribs show a tendency to disappear. The wisdom teeth have become rudimentary organs and are entirely lacked by 42% of Europeans. It is prophesied that the double molars will follow suit. The intestinal duct is ever growing briefer and the army of the bald ever increasing. From the Confessions of a Physician, page 211. Dr. W. A. Chappell says, quote, in New Zealand, the ratio of defectives, including deaf and dumb lunatics, epileptics, paralytics, crippled and deformed, debilitated and infirm, has gone from 5.4 per thousand over 15 years in 1874 to 11.4 in 1896, slightly declining to 10.29 in 1901. The ratio of lunatics has gone up from 1.9 in 1874 to 3.4 in 1901, from the fertility of the unfit. This would indicate that the decline is far more rapid in the salubrious climate of New Zealand, even more so than in this country, a fact which makes immediate investigation all the more urgent. As the title of his book implies, Dr. Chappell ascribes this condition to the indiscriminate reproduction of the unfit. He says, quote, society is breeding from a defective stock. The best fit to produce the best offspring are ceasing to produce their own kind, while the fertility of the worst remains undisturbed. Close quote. A charge which, according to the views of many, might be brought against society in most civilized countries, but although somewhat significant, would be hardly sufficient to produce such rapid deterioration. Dr. Verasaf tells us further what we may expect in the near future if we continue at the present pace. Quote, in the same way as ordinary plain food is no more considered a suitable diet for us, so in the future will natural air become irrational, being too rare and impure for our small and delicate lungs. Man will carry an apparatus filled with concentrated pure oxygen about with him, inhaling it through a little tube, and if his apparatus suddenly goes wrong, will perish from suffocation in the free air of heaven exactly like a stranded fish. The human eye, transformed into a rudimentary and inflamed organ, will be in daily need of syringing, rinsing and cleaning. Wine, tobacco, tea, etc., losing their stimulating properties, humanity will pass on to new and more potent poisons. Fecundation will be accomplished artificially, as being too gross for man, the amorous instinct finding satisfaction in voluptuous embraces and other irritants. Close quote. The doctor is not treating this matter as a huge joke, as some might be led to think, or even trying to impose on the credulity of his readers, but is seriously dealing with a very serious question. It may be that it is yet a far cry from the present condition of the human race to that predicted by Mr. K. Robinson or Dr. Verasaf. Yet it must be acknowledged that we are a very long way from physical perfection, and it may be that there is not so vast a difference in the two conditions as there is in the present state of the human race, and that which prevailed among the barbarian inhabitants of Europe prior to the Roman conquest. This question, it would of course be difficult to decide, but by what we may gather from the fragmentary evidence handed down to us, these barbarians must have been exceedingly robust. End of chapter 2.